Podo. You're listening to Movers and Shakers, a podcast about living with Parkinson's. The show is sponsored by Judge Nick Mostyn's Old Chambers and by the generous contributions of private donors.
And welcome to Movers and Shakers, the podcast about living with Parkinson's. I'm Gillian Lacey-Solomar, and today we're tackling a big subject, what causes PD? So today's a bit less about us moaning and laughing, and more about getting the root of this wretched illness. I mean, how come we have it and other people don't? Maybe you're asking yourself, how come I have it, but my brother, sister, mum, dad, whoever it is, cousin, best friend, doesn't? So let's see who's here to help me unpick this rather tangled topic.
Rory Kethlin-Jones.
Paul Mayhew Archer.
Mark Mardell.
Nicholas Mostyn.
And unfortunately, Jeremy can't be here with us today. So let's dive in. Now, do you all remember the World Parkinson's Congress?
Well, I do. I was there.
And Paul was there too, weren't you? Yeah.
I was jealous, so I wasn't there.
And neither was the judge.
I was still judging.
I was in Swansea. Three dozen leaving parties.
I was in Swansea, yes.
The longest farewell since Frank Sinatra.
Well, in that case, better reprise some of what was said. We all picked somebody to interview, and my chosen interviewee there was this guy called Ray Dorsey, who's a bit of a giant in the area in every sense. He's well over 6.5 foot tall, but he'd also written a book called Ending Parkinson's, which talks about the way to bring the illness to a close is to prevent it from happening in the first place. I put it to him that we're not doing that well in terms of halting PD at the moment.
No, we're not, and we should take some blame for that, quite frankly. Parkinson's disease is the world's fastest growing brain disease. The number of people with the disease has more than doubled in the last 25 years, and if we don't do anything differently, it's going to double again. And no one's really quite paying enough attention to it. The fact that it's growing so rapidly should be a call to action, and maybe should call us to think that we should be doing things a little bit differently than we are currently. If I'm right that air pollution, pesticides, and dry cleaning chemicals are causing it, you should be avoiding those things like the plague if you have the disease, right? So buy organic produce, wash all your fruits and vegetables with soap and water, avoid air pollution, avoid subways if you can do so, avoid dry cleaning your clothes unless you get a green dry cleaner. Put a water filter on your water. So there are lots of things that people with the disease can do right now to reduce their exposure to these toxicants, which are likely driving.
That was Ray Dorsey talking to me in Barcelona.
And I thought at the time it was complete nonsense, isn't it?
I remember you being very sceptical. Why?
To say that it's caused by fertilisers or the environment or air pollution, does that mean that Parkinson's disease is unknown in places which don't have those things that are...
You would have thought it'd be easy to test
you? You would think that.
Also, it worries me whether the campaigners against pesticides, which may be a very legitimate thing to campaign against, are just hooking on to this.
Quite possibly. Well, we'll hear from our expert in a moment.
I was similarly sceptical, and I posed this question for our expert to address as well. I thought it was an established scientific fact that if we all lived to 120, we would all have Parkinson's. Therefore, Parkinson's is nothing causes Parkinson's. It's part of our biological makeup. And that we who have got Parkinson's now just happen to be the statistical outliers who are getting it sooner than people would otherwise get it.
That's a massive topic and we'll be going into that. And Paul?
I don't know. I mean, I literally don't know at all anymore. I mean, I grew up in my dad ran a hardware shop, so he sold weed killers. Is that because of the reason I've got Parkinson's? Or is it genetic? Or is it something else?
Or is it just we're all going to get it?
But is it slightly odd that five of us here come from the BBC? Where we hang around
the
water coolers? The BBC gives you Parkinson's.
Wrong water? Don't know. Or is it just that the BBC is
huge? It's a Daily Mail headline, isn't it? BBC gives you Parkinson's.
Well, shall we see if it does? So our expert with us today is Professor Matt Farah, who's a Brit. But after training at Imperial, he crossed the Atlantic. He was made a professor at the age of only 36 in 2006 at the world-renowned Mayo Clinic. He's now professor of neurology at the University of Florida and directs the lab on neurogenetics and neuroscience. And he happens to be one of the world's leading experts on genetics in Parkinson's.
Well, he sounds a top guy.
He is pretty top guy, but actually he's quite nice as well, I think. Let's give him a go.
I don't buy it.
Tell us, what was your reaction to that clip?
Well, I think Ray's a little bit behind the times, and I think he misunderstands Parkinson's disease and the effort that's ongoing scientifically to solve it, to understand where it comes from, what causes it. Environment's very important. There's no doubt about it. But the environment works on biology, on organisms, on human beings, right? And some people, unfortunately, have susceptibility to Parkinson's disease that perhaps the environment triggers. But that's very difficult to pin down. One thing we can pin down unequivocally is what that genetic foundation really is. My analogy for this is a bit like a motor car. A motor car engine. It's responsible for moving the car. It's responsible for motion, right? To be able to fix that when it goes wrong, you have to understand its component parts. You have to understand when you lift up the bonnet that it's got a battery and an alternator and there's spark plugs and there's a fan belt and there's radiators and all these component parts have to work together in synchrony to get the motor to run. And when I started in this field 25 plus years ago, we had no idea when you lift up the bonnet what was underneath it. No notion. And now we know what many of the component parts are, and we're starting to figure out, certainly with the most recent discovery, how they work together. And it's phenomenal. Once we realize that, and once the world realizes and the field realizes that, then we can find ways in which we can intervene really effectively to slow down potentially or to stop Parkinson's disease. I like the idea of halting the condition and preventing it before it even occurs in people who are susceptible.
And what have you discovered?
Lots of things. But
are you allowed to tell us what
it is? Yeah, of course. So the most recent gene for Parkinson's disease is called RAB32. It probably doesn't mean anything to very many people, but it's a very important component of this engine. And it links together several of the other genes for Parkinson's disease, namely PINK1, VPS35, LERK2, Parkin.
And have we all got all of those genes, all of us with Parkinson's?
Everybody has about 21,000 genes, and you have all of the above.
Right.
But some people have mutations in them, variability in them, that predisposes them to Parkinson's disease.
And how can you detect those?
I work with families around the world, kind of knock on my door, I knock on their door, and it's very humbling to be invited in to hear about their history and their troubles with Parkinson's disease. Not just their troubles, but troubles down the family line, generation after generation. And I work with them. I get blood samples of buccal swabs and I sequence their genomes. And I look to see in those families if there's something special about their genome that's different in people with the disease versus people without the disease.
So when I hear it's genetic, that means to me it's inherited. Is that a straightforward?
So shades of grey. There is black and white. And it can be inherited, but there's lots of shades of grey as well. So there's what we call polygenic risk as well. There's lots of subtle variability that combined together predisposes risk. And that can be almost as strong as inheriting it from your parents and grandparents, etc., down the family line. But there's lots of shades of grey.
Now, I've talked to people in London trying to map the Parkinson's brain as the route to really understanding it. Is that what your work involves? Looking deep into the brain and saying, what's going wrong here?
There's lots of different types of cartographers in the world, making diagrams of how it works, how places are connected, how you can travel from one to the next. And my work's really focused on fundamental atomic resolution, kind of precision of these component parts. What are the component parts and how do they work together?
How do you get those incredibly close-up pictures, as it were?
Through DNA.
Right.
Through DNA. Strings of A's, G's, C's and T's.
When we're told about something called alpha-synuclein, what is that?
DNA makes protein. About 1% of your genome is what we call coding, and the coding part makes proteins. And alpha-synuclein is a protein that's encoded by a gene called alpha-synuclein 2.
And what role does it play in Parkinson's?
Well, the first gene that was found for Parkinson's disease was found in an Italian family, the Cantersi kindred, had an A53T mutation, a single change that predisposed people who inherited it to Parkinson's disease. Many, many, many people in the families.
Well, what do you say to my point, which is that Parkinson's is a universal condition? The mean is at around 90 years old. It's got a high standard deviation. And we're just, unfortunately, you know, the ones who are on the left-hand side of the graph, and the people at the right-hand side of the graph, well, they're all killed by something else before they have a chance to die from Parkinson's.
You could probably make the same argument for almost any medical condition. We might all die of cancer first, or we might all die of some other disorder. So I think it's valid.
But not particularly useful.
No, but Professor Chowdhury does, he's very emphatic that if it was 120, everybody would have Parkinson's. I mean, do you agree with that?
On what basis does he come to that conclusion?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not the expert.
I'm a scientist.
Presumably, one does it because the rate of getting Parkinson's increases as you.
It strikes me as pretty useless, though, as a theory, because the point is that some of us get it faster, and that's what you need to research.
When I heard it, I thought it was a metaphor saying if you reach 90, you will have Parkinson's-like symptoms rather than you will actually have.
You'll be stiff and slow and tremulous maybe stooped and masked. I don't think it's an inevitable consequence of aging at all. I've met many nonagenarians, centenarians who are able-bodied, cognitively, physically, motorically normal. It's not an inevitable consequence of aging. It's nonsense. It's a disease.
You talked about shades of grey and black and white. Is genetics not black and white? Isn't that the answer?
Some forms of genetics are black and white. I mean, we call those Mendelian diseases, after Mendel and his peas, where you can say clearly if someone's got a mutation, they're going to inherit the condition.
Right.
And often,
what illnesses are those?
In Parkinson's disease, it's typically patients who perhaps have synuclein multiplication mutations. That's probably one extreme example. It may be patients with PINK1, Parkin knockout mutations. It may be patients with VPS35 mutations, perhaps patients with LERK2 mutations. When I started 25 years ago, there weren't any of this. There was no notion of genes and causality. And now there's many, many genes and lots of causal factors in PD.
You found out a lot then.
We found out a lot. Has it
taken us any further forward in thinking of ways of combating it?
Absolutely, yeah. Again, come back to that motor car analogy. If you know the component parts, how they fit together, how the engine works and how it should work and how it should run, when it breaks, you've got some clue as how to fix it, right? If your car stops on the motorway and you've already heard a squeaking noise from the engine and you open up the bonnet and you see steam hissing out of it, what are you going to look for?
I wouldn't know.
Yes.
I'm going to look for the number of the AA.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you might look at the fan belt and see if it's still attached to the car and the radiator's cooling down. You might just see if there's any fluid in the radiator, if the water's all gone, if the car's overheating. You might look at the dial on the dashboard and see if it's overheating.
Yes.
There's a variety of things. If you have no notion of what's under the bonnet, you don't
clearly
know what to...
Don't.
It's nonsense. Where are you going to start?
My father is aged 90, and he is, in fact, living proof that Professor Chowdhury's theory is not necessarily valid. He's completely articulate, but he does keep telling the same jokes.
Okay. We keep hearing the same old stories from you.
That's true. Do you remember those Beetle cars? Those old Volkswagens that everybody drove around in the 70s? Do you remember those?
Yeah,
anyhow, so a little old lady is driving up the motorway and her Beetle stops and she thinks, that's very odd. She gets out, she opens the bonnet, there's no engine. So she's sitting there, what's happened to the engine? And then another Beetle turns up behind with another old lady who says, I see you've got a problem that your engine's missing. But I've discovered I've got a spare one in my boot. He loves that joke.
Yeah. Can you turn that joke into a genetics metaphor?
In a sense, I already have. We have to figure out what that machine is. And I think we're very close to knowing exactly what the machine
is. And then what will that lead you to do? Will that lead you down the path of gene therapy rather than new drugs?
No. I think it'll lead us to small molecule drugs that will basically help stop, slow, prevent the condition.
But when you reeled off that list of
genes and proteins,
I hadn't realised quite so much how... You're saying that each one of us around the table might have a different cause of our Parkinson's, is that right?
Potentially, yes. Everybody's unique, right? Nobody here around this table probably presented with the same symptoms at the same time, same ages of onset, and none of you really know, looking into the future, if you're all going to develop the disease in the same way.
No.
Some of you may develop it in rather more unfortunate ways than others.
Is it right to call it Parkinson's, or is it a whole spread of diseases?
I think it's a really wise decision to call it one term from a funding point of view, a political point of view. You know, it's better, strength in numbers. But from a genetic point of view, there is a common etiology to this. There's a common beginning to this, for sure.
What is that?
It's a personal view, but all of the major genes for Parkinson's disease that we can say unequivocally are causal for the condition all impinge around one central mechanism. It's the same mechanism for all of them, right? And it's got to do with your immune system, how your immune system copes with invading pathogens like a bacteria. So when bacteria are in your system, your cells, your white blood cells, come and engulf those bacteria. They wrap those bacteria in a coat, and then they stop them from growing. That's the first thing to do. And second thing to do is to come and digest them. So the enzyme that's used to stop them from growing is a conotate. It comes from mitochondria. And what's used to digest them are lysosomes. Lysosome-related organelles are moved to this bacterial coat, if you like, or this encapsulated bacterium. They slowly digest that bacteria. All of the major genes of Parkinson's disease are involved in that mechanism. Now, somehow or other, they all lead to the death of dopaminergic neurons in the brain.
Is it that they don't know how to stop doing what they're doing, that they start cloaking other things in? They get out of control, these things that are...
The link between the immune system in the periphery and what's going on in terms of the loss of dopaminergic neurons in the brain is really unclear.
I mean, this is all very complicated. It sounds to me that, though, you've still got quite a long way to go. Is that unfair?
There is a long way to go. There is a long way to go, and I'd really like your help to get to the finish line before I die.
Yeah.
Fascinating. We've got to get on with it. I'm a pragmatist. We've got to get on with it. And what I don't like about, for example, with all due respect to Dr. Dorsey's view, it's not pragmatic.
We're not going to stop all pesticides and clean all air pollution.
And even if we did, we don't know that those agents are indeed causal for the condition. There's an association, for sure. But if you go to, for example, to a rotenone factory or a paraquat factory and you interview everybody who's worked there or ever worked there and been heavily, potentially exposed to it, I don't pick on paraquat, but I pick on rotenone because it's mostly produced in the developing world.
Paraquat is produced in the UK and banned in the UK, but exported around the world.
So they may say they have all the safety precautions in the world to stop any exposure for anyone who works in those factories. Somehow I doubt it. But is the incidence higher in those factories, in the workers who are around this chemical the whole time? Has anyone looked? Has anyone bothered to even find out and ask?
Well, yes, there was a story quite recently about that.
And what was the answer?
The company behind it said it wasn't higher, but then their methods were absolutely questioned. There was a controversy over whether they had looked quite closely enough.
So there's room for doubt, and it was borderline in terms of the results.
Yeah.
So and that will be the case that if we study the environment for the next 20 years, we're going to get the same answers, borderline.
So you're saying that's not the route. The route is, no. I'm still not quite clear, what is the route? Once you found out the Holy Grail, which is the secret of Parkinson's, what you do about it?
The important thing is to find out how the motor, what the motor consists of, right? What the mechanism is, what the individual components are. And the way to get that is to basically get people, for the most part, with either young onset, familial or a typical Parkinson's disease, to take part in genome sequencing and to contribute. You find bigger effects at the tails of the distribution, at the extremes. Mm-hmm. People with young onset Parkinson's disease are the extreme. People with familial Parkinson's disease, I mean one or more other members of your family with a neurologic condition that looks like Parkinsonism, they're the extremes as well. Mm-hmm. And then atypical, again, an extreme, you're more likely to get a return on your investment.
And so you would like those people to take part in what kind of trials? Are there trials going
on? A trial, basically spit into a tube, donate some DNA. You can do it in a de-identified or an anonymized way. But the one thing that goes with that sample is this person has Parkinson's disease, perhaps age of onset. The richer the phenotype, the better. And that data to be assembled and compiled together and interrogated.
Let's just define what phenotype is so people know what you're talking about.
Oh, presentation. Symptoms, signs, clinical presentation.
Okay.
Simplest thing in terms of phenotype would be age of onset. How old were you when you first thought you were affected by the condition?
So who is doing that work? If we
lots of
samples.
Different groups around the world are doing that work. In the UK, you can actually get whole genome sequencing done for free if you had a diagnosis under the age of 50, and through Genome England, they actually do it.
Except it's very theoretical at the moment. I've tried that 6 times to get it done.
It's helped me find the latest gene for Parkinson's disease. There are 778 patients with young onset Parkinson's disease who've done that in the UK, as far as I know, right now, which is a trivial, tiny, tiny, tiny number, but my hat's off to them for taking part. It would be great if more people would take part. Genome England is actually funding this and supporting this. And basically it goes with the clinical records of those individuals when they take part. You ask the question, you find out this information, you find out what these genes are, you find out the mechanism, if you like, the motor, what it looks like, then what do you do about
it? Yeah, how do you stop it?
That was your question, right? What do you do about it? So there's some very practical illustrations of that. One of the most common forms of Parkinson's disease that's genetically encoded is called LRRK2, leucine rich repeat kinase 2 Parkinsonism. And what we've discovered, it looks just like clinical, typical Parkinson's disease, a little bit younger in terms of age of onset, but otherwise it's identical. We can't tell the difference. The same variability. There's some patients developing it in their 30s, some people in their 80s, has the same constellation of features. But LRRK2 itself is a massive, big protein, but it's known as a kinase. And how it works is how kinases work. They take other proteins and they add a phosphate group to them. It's very simple, but it's a bit like the mutation in all mutations, I should say, in LRRK2, basically activate kinase activity, its own kinase activity. It's almost like the door of the room is ajar. It's constantly open. Substrate can come in and out and be phosphorylated at will. The mutation basically forces that door ajar. And what we need to do is to find a small molecule that will come in and block the doorway, right? Not all the time, but just some of the time.
And the end result being that those dopamine cells would survive longer or be repaired.
Yeah, they would die at a slower rate, and perhaps they wouldn't die at all. And if you caught people early enough by a genetic diagnosis of LRRK2 Parkinsonism, even before they get symptoms, perhaps they'd never develop disease at all.
Going back to the car engine metaphor. So you've got, say, you've got a smart car, you've got six cylinders in your car, and two of the cylinders are packed up completely, okay? So you've got four cylinders, and they're in quite bad shape. So what you do is you're going to try and get the most out of your four cylinders by cleaning the spark plugs, cleaning the inside of the cylinders, replacing the spark cable. You're going to do that. What I'm moving towards, is there scope for making our brains work better by these enzyme blockers?
Potentially, yes. I think so. I think we're doing it naturally. I think you're compensating. Right now, you're compensating. The reason why your movement disorder is not as bad as it can be at some times in the day is because you're compensating. In some ways, it's the drugs, it's the levodopa. In other ways, it's your own body, it's your own chemistry, it's the beer maybe you drank. But you're compensating, and your brain is compensating. It's a carefully balanced operation. Dopamine basically is a neuromodulator that kind of slows things down and tempers, if you like, all of the input that's coming in from your cerebral cortex into your striatum. And it's saying, it's making these go, no-go decisions for you, which is the problem for movement initiation in Parkinson's disease. And when it's out of balance is when you get those problems. Mm-hmm. It's when you stop, when you freeze, fascination, all of these. It's not arising out of the chair that's the problem. It's actually starting to make the movement, right? You all probably know this far better than I. The brain tries to compensate the whole time. I'll give you an example, dopaminergic neurons. There's a lot of dopamine, not that many dopaminergic. I work mostly on mice rather than humans, so I don't remember the exact number of dopaminergic neurons in a human being, but in a mouse, it's about 11,000. And each dopaminergic neuron in a mouse has a single axon, and it goes into the striatum of the mouse, and it branches like a tree. On a single axon, a single trunk, if you like, there's 450 or so thousand terminal branches. In a human being, in a human dopaminergic neuron, a single trunk, if you like, the axon of dopaminergic neuron, branches to about 1.2 million branches. But it's not static. It's constantly being pruned and clipped. It's like a bush inside your brain. It's not hardware or software. It's liveware. It's constantly being pruned and maintained. And the pruning and the maintenance of that is also challenged in Parkinson's and changed, perhaps improved, perhaps allowing you to compensate more and overcome some challenges.
Do only humans get Parkinson's? I mean, looking at my dog here.
your dog has a substantia nigra, has black substance in its brain and has dopaminergic innervation, but dogs don't get Parkinson's disease. And it is considered probably to be a human-specific condition.
So why would that be?
That's very interesting, isn't it?
Your guess is as good. Almost as good as mine.
Apes get it?
Do you what?
Apes get it?
No.
Well, but you give it to apes, don't you?
So Parkinson's.
I don't personally, but
people do it in order to study the research.
Mostly to look at medications for dyskinesias.
I'm still grappling trying to understand the science behind this, but it seems to me what you were saying about this particular molecule that you've just identified means that it is possible to cure it.
I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think it had the potential to halt disease progression.
Mm.
That equates to a cure in those individuals who've who've yet to manifest symptoms or are early in the disease or perhaps even advanced in their disease. To halt progression is, I think, the best we could do.
Rory's joke, anyway, that it's always 5 years in the future, a cure. I mean, how far do you think something that halts the progression is off?
Well, I think we have to be pragmatic about it. Right, we have to stop wasting time and effort and money and resources. Different people have different viewpoints, and I'm very biased. I'm a geneticist, statistical geneticist, neuroscientist, and I'd say we have to get on with focus on the real problem. And it's not environmental contributions to this disease; it's understanding the mechanism, the motor, finding these component parts. And the way to do that is to get every person with young onset Parkinson's disease or familial Parkinson's disease, and potentially atypical Parkinsonism, to take part in a genome sequencing effort. They're ongoing, they're global, they're funded to a certain degree around the world. That needs to be pushed because we need to accelerate this. We found, in terms of major causal genes for the condition, maybe 8 of them, and it's taken 20 years.
And how many more do you
expect to find? It could have been done in a year if we'd have gone on with it, right? How many more are there? I believe there's a lot, but they're going to get harder to find, because the effect size are getting smaller.
So give us a timescale for, if everything goes well, what will happen?
We'll find all the component parts of the machine. We'll understand how the machine runs. And when it's broken, we'll have a direct atomic resolution idea of where and how to fix it. With small molecules, maybe with gene therapy, but with small molecules for sure. How long does that take? It takes generally 20 years to bring a drug to market, perhaps longer, and typically several billion dollars.
So the drugs that are coming to market, well, they're in stage 3 trials at the moment.
There's a few.
They're false dawns.
The entire pharmaceutical industry now, whether no matter what the disorder is being studied, no matter what the drug is being developed, is based on a genetic foundation. Pharma does not invest in drugs unless it's based on genetics, because genetics is the foundation. It's foundational. And Parkinson's disease would do really well if it built out that foundation. And it hasn't happened to the degree that it has to happen yet. It needs to happen, and it needs to hurry up and happen.
Your overall message is the answer to this is genetics, and we've gone away from that. We need a much more focused emphasis on genetics.
Absolutely. It's really important. We can't be dicking about with trichloroethylene or even paraquat or all the rest of it. There's so many different opinions, right? But there's only one truth, and that's genetics.
And we can put this on our website, but what do you want people to do?
I would like every person with young onset Parkinson's disease in the UK today to go and see their neurologist and say, I was diagnosed with this condition or developed this condition under the age of 50, and I would like to participate in genome sequencing through the UK Biobank's effort at no cost to you. Give me a buccal swab or phlebotomy, whatever it takes. Fill in the forms, make it happen.
Loads to think about, incredibly complicated, but it seems that your core message is clear. Genetics is the answer.
And pragmatism. You know, we don't need to sequence the whole entire planet. We don't need to sequence everybody with Parkinson's disease necessarily. By all means, let's do it. But I think we need to get on with it and sequence everybody. Anyone who's got young onset Parkinson's disease, please take part.
Please do. Thank you.
You've been listening to Movers and Shakers, a podcast about living with Parkinson's. The show is sponsored by Judge Nick Mostyn's Old Chambers and by the generous contributions of private donors. The show is produced by Nick Hilton for Poddo. Our theme music is by Alex Stubbs and cover artwork by Till Lucat. Please subscribe to get new episodes straight into your podcast app and do rate and review if you enjoyed the show. We have a brand new all-singing, all-dancing website with lots more information about each episode. You will find it at www.moversandshakerspodcast.com. And please email any thoughts or questions to feedback@moversandshakerspodcast.com. See you next week.